What?
Electric Ladyland.
On January 21st, 1968, Jimi Hendrix, armed with a tape of Bob Dylan's All Along the Watchtower, walked into Olympic Studios in London and began recording a cover version. The story goes that Hendrix recorded guitar take after guitar take after guitar take, layering out the audio, erasing the audio, recording it again, drawing upon nearly every musical influence he had percolating in his noggin. Bass player Noel Redding became so infuriated at Hendrix that he left halfway through the recording session. But have a listen at this part. Now, doesn't that sound awfully close to this? That's Bubber Miley performing the solo on Duke Ellington's East St. Louis Toodaloo. When Jimi Hendrix first heard this, he wanted to reproduce the sound on his guitar with his wah-wah pedal. Now, I had no idea about any of this until I read Terry Teachout's Duke, his latest biography about Duke Ellington, which also happens to be longlisted for the National Book Award. Now, that's one of the great dangers of reading Terry Teachout. He's so good at showing you the musical influence that if you have even the vaguest curiosity or slight geekiness about music, you quickly find yourself falling down a YouTube rabbit hole, as I did one weekend. And if you read the show notes, I have linked to many of the reference songs brought up in the conversation that you are about to hear. My name is Edward Champion, and this is the Bat Segundo Show. I met up with Terry Teachout to discuss Duke Ellington, his sexiness, his philandering, his politics, the way he exploited poor Billy Strayhorn, and his indelible hold upon American music. Okay, so I am here once again with the delightful Terry Teachout, who is most recently the author of Duke. Terry, how are you doing?
I'm hanging in there.
Hanging in there, okay.
Yes, book tours,
I see you're clutching the desk with every single strained effort you have left. So let's get into it. I want to start from a very geeky musical technical question, seeing as how you've been doing more music composition yourself. You point out that Duke Ellington thought almost exclusively in terms of vertical harmony.
Yes.
Rather than horizontal melody, that his best-known tunes were little more than elaborations on the top notes of chord progressions. You quote Gunther Schuller in early jazz about him noticing the parallel blocks of sound he favors so predominantly are handled with such variety that we as listeners never notice the lack of occasional contrapuntal relief. You suggest that this compositional liability, which Duke was in fact able to work around, led him to sort of rely on other composers, other musicians, band members, and of course, he didn't always share credit. So I'm wondering, to what degree was Duke himself aware of this creative liability? How was he able to keep so many of his collaborators and even the audience who was listening to him in the dark about this for so long?
Well, a lot of it has to do with the fact that Ellington was the biggest public personality in his band. I mean, his great soloists, except for Ben Webster, who was known to beat up people, tended not to have that kind of flashy personality. So even though, if you look on the credits of a song like I'm Beginning to See the Light, you'll see Johnny Hodges' name on there, you're not going to think of Hodges, you're going to think of Ellington, because Ellington is the trademark of the Ellington band. And this is even true in the case of Billy Strayhorn, a composer of equal quality, and I think maybe equal genius to Ellington, but Strayhorn is completely in the background. He doesn't appear with the band, maybe a half dozen times in the band's whole life. I've only seen one bit of film with Strayhorn playing with the Ellington band at a gig. So even though for the last 15 years or so of their working together, their albums were jointly credited to Ellington and Strayhorn, and that's to be taken very seriously. The fact is that if you don't know the score, if you don't know how important Strayhorn is, you're going to assume that Ellington is the senior partner.
Yeah. And actually, there's also a wonderful book by David Haydu, Lush Life, as well. Let's talk about Strayhorn. He's one of the tragic figures in this book.
Yes.
He's a man. He has composed and arranged many of the Duke's finest moments. The Duke, as we are implying here and establishing here, was an incessant credit hog, and he strung
Strayhorn along for decades. So, you know, I'm wondering, what was it about the Duke's charisma? I mean, it was so formidable that he even attracted women when he was close to death, when he was actually ill, which was really impressive, I gotta
say. I was
pretty
amazed by that myself, yes.
What caused people like Strayhorn and other people who were ribbed of their credit or robbed of their credit, what kept them coming back to the Duke?
He was what he was. He was a genius. I mean, Strayhorn became what he became because Ellington was his model. And also, I mean, we have to talk about the specific nature of Strayhorn's life and personality and why it worked for him to work for Ellington. Billy Strayhorn was a homosexual.
Yeah.
You were not a homosexual who was out and a public figure, least of all if you were black in the world of jazz in the 30s and 40s. This was not an option for Strayhorn. And Strayhorn, who was completely at ease with his sexuality, wished to live his life the way he wanted to live it. So he made a kind of bargain with himself, with the world, and with Ellington, that he would remain on the sidelines. Ellington would pay him quite generously, as a matter of fact. Strayhorn essentially had the equivalent of a drawing account and could do pretty much whatever he wanted. And in return for this, and supplying this music and writing hundreds of uncredited arrangements for Ellington, he just steps back into the shadows and lets Edward, as he always called him, we'll let Edward do that, would be Strayhorn's line. And Ellington, unlike Strayhorn, was not only a creative personality, but a kind of a theatrical figure. One of Duke Ellington's greatest creations was Duke Ellington.
Yeah.
The man who goes out on stage with the fabulous outfits and the baggy eyes and the gorgeous bass baritone voice and the catchphrases, and he charms your socks off. Now, even if he couldn't have done all of this, he would have still been Duke Ellington, the great composer. But because he served it up with all that frosting, people who might not otherwise have been drawn to him, and especially, we talk about race again, especially drawn to a black man in the 20s and 30s, this is a different kind of black man. This is the elegant, presentable fellow. And that is an important part of what Ellington was. And Strayhorn knew, consciously or not, that he needed this kind of front man to lead the kind of life he wanted to lead, and be able to have that great Ellington band play his music the way it played Ellington's music.
Do we really know in 2013 the full extent of Strayhorn's contributions
exactly,
to Ellington?
Because
I mean, it's come out over and over in the last several decades. We have suddenly understood, oh, well, he did this, he did this, he
It's
wrote
completely
this.
Knowable now because the manuscripts have survived. And a lot of people in Ellington's life and Strayhorn's life and for many years after it speculated about who wrote what. And now, it's not a matter of speculation. We know right down to the fact that Billy Strayhorn wrote the last 10 bars of Ellington's Harlem, for example. That's the level of specificity on which we could know it. So there is a debunking line that's gotten about that, you know, Strayhorn was the power behind the throne, and that's just not true. In the suites that they wrote together, Strayhorn would normally compose maybe between a third and a quarter of the numbers. They were not written jointly. They were each, the movements are separate. There's a Strayhorn movement, there's an Ellington movement.
You described that moment in the hotel room where they're trading off. One
right.
goes to sleep and one
it's
goes
a wonderful
to the,
story, but
there's
it's
a monster
an unusual,
to be playing in the back.
It's an unusual thing to have happen.
Yeah.
So Strayhorn's contribution is immensely important, and he didn't get, for these complicated reasons we've talked about, complete credit for it. But most of the music that we believe is written by Duke Ellington was written by Duke Ellington, including virtually all of his major instrumental works. The real problem of attribution with Ellington is the pop songs.
Yeah.
And that is, for me, that was the big surprise when I started to really go systematically into the Ellington output. I'd heard stories about this, I'd heard stories about that. But suddenly, as I looked at the work as a totality, the light went on and I realized, well, of course, it's the pop songs because he's not a natural melody writer. It stands to reason that that would be where he went.
Yeah.
To those wonderful natural melody improvisers like Johnny Hodges.
The pop songs not only reveal Duke's limitations, it also reveals how much he plundered from other people.
Yes, that's right. But here's another side of it. It also reveals what his essential contribution is. It's in a song like Sophisticated Lady, that's the most striking example of this. The main strain is by Lawrence Brown, the trombone player. The bridge, the release, is by Otto Hardwick, the alto saxophone player. But it was Duke Ellington's idea to take these two 8-bar fragments and put them together in a 32-bar pop song and harmonize them and orchestrate it and create the total composition that we know as Sophisticated Lady. So who wrote what? The question is, and the answer is, Ellington didn't write the melody, but it is his composer's mind that took these two found objects, if you want to put it that way, and transformed them into the song Sophisticated Lady. So it's a complex attribution problem. You can't just sum it up by saying, oh yes, Duke Ellington was a plagiarist. Duke Ellington was never, in the sense that a literary person normally uses the term, a plagiarist.
Yeah.
He didn't steal without telling you, and then you looked up 6 months later and, you know, your work was in print under his name.
He was not the Jonah Lehrer of...
No, sir. Not in the slightest. That was he scrupulous? Not always. And sometimes he was entirely unscrupulous. And sometimes unscrupulous things were done in his name. A fair number of Strayhorn pieces, the royalties were copyrighted in Ellington's name, but there's no reason to assume that Ellington himself was responsible for that.
Yeah.
It may, in some cases, just have been sloppy bookkeeping.
Yeah.
But when Strayhorn finally did look into this, he was horrified, and it led to a temporary break between the two men, and ultimately to the renegotiation of billing that created the later Ellington-Strayhorn compositions, where they always get equal billing.
Yeah. I'm abashed almost to say this, but I have not once mentioned the Cotton Club in more than 500 shows of Bat Segundo. So well, thank goodness you wrote about it, Terry.
Now's the time.
Now is the time, and I wanted to get into this.
Sure.
You know, here was a segregated venue, a place that paid its performers quite handsomely.
And mobbed up to the eyebrows.
That's right. Langston Hughes railed against how most whites who attended the Cotton Club saw the cabarets rather than the houses of Harlem. Duke played there. But he didn't really mention a lot of this other aspect of the Cotton Club in his memoir, Music Is My Mistress.
Right.
But he also broadcast on CBS Radio from the Cotton Club, this risk taken by William Paley, and he got the attention of the press simultaneously by playing Midtown clubs. So he has these broadcasts through CBS that get him national attention, while simultaneously, I mean, it had me wondering, was there any other way for Duke to make his way to CBS without the Cotton Club? Was he going to face racial segregation no matter what path he took?
Oh, sure. I mean, remember, we're talking about 1927, 1928. Black bands get paid less. They get inferior gigs. So suddenly, Ellington gets this break, and it's an extraordinary break. The price he pays for it is he's coming into a segregated club in the middle of Harlem.
Yeah.
You know, where the only way that a black person can get in is if they're very famous, and then they put them in a table in the corner, preferably in the shadows. But in return for that, the Cotton Club's got a national radio wire on CBS. Every rich person in New York is going to hear him. The word gets around, and that radio wire suddenly puts Duke Ellington in your living room, no matter where you live. So I think the biggest break that ever happened to Duke Ellington was meeting Irving Mills. The second biggest, and it's related to this, is going into the Cotton Club. That and Mills's publicity campaign presenting Ellington as a different kind of black man.
Yeah.
You fuse those together and you get the route to the great success that Ellington had by the 30s.
But when Mills was no longer around, Ellington seems to collapse. Did he really take any hard lessons, or did he actually... Did any of the hard lessons he learned from Mills actually be taken to heart in later years? Because, I mean, I was reading this book, and my mouth was agog, and what a terrible organizer he was. He tolerated his band coming in at odd hours, any hours, even not even showing up to the actual gig. He tolerated musicians who were hopped up on heroin, who
it
were
alcoholics. It was the most irresponsible band, maybe in jazz. But, you have to remember that Duke Ellington had a very clear sense of priorities. He knew what he wanted. He wanted a band that would play his music every night. He was willing to put up with an enormous amount of nonsense from extraordinarily gifted players because they were the particular guys that he wanted on the stand at the time. He was never a businessman. And when he worked with organized businessmen after Mills, Mills really ran the show, but after that, they had to do things within the parameters of the way Ellington wanted them to be done. You know, if you'd brought in a hard-ass manager in 1956 to transform the situation with the Ellington band, you know, probably the first thing he would have done would have been to fire Paul Gonsalves, you know, this man who was simultaneously an alcoholic and a heroin addict, you know, who would nod off on the bandstand. But if you'd made that smart business decision, then you wouldn't have had Paul Gonsalves on the bandstand for the 1956 Newport Jazz Festival, where he plays a million choruses on diminuendo and crescendo and blue, and the crowd explodes, yes, and Ellington's on the cover of Time magazine. So I think in the long run, Ellington wasn't interested in money.
Yeah,
he wanted an operation that would allow him to lead the life he wanted, which was a life on the road, a life where a lot of women were passing through his life, a life lived in hotel rooms, and a life where his music gets played every night. He didn't want to be a millionaire. He wouldn't have known what to do with it.
But before that 1959 Newport appearance, he is really on the skids. I mean, it seems like he is not going to come back. But even with that Newport appearance that is a huge sensation, he's going on to Ed Sullivan, and he's sharing the bill with Herman's Hermits.
Well, and, yes, the world has changed.
Yes.
Ellington predates the big band era, but it was the booster rocket that made him the culture celebrity that he was in the 40s. But he outlived it. After World War II, the whole first, you know, big bands themselves become financially dicey, and then the whole flavor of pop music changes. You know, you have rhythm and blues, which soaks up the black audience that had formerly listened to jazz. You have rock and roll becoming the lingua franca of modern music. And so by 56, Ellington was perceived pretty widely as yesterday's news.
Yeah.
And it wasn't just him. It was everybody who was playing that kind of music. This incredible good fortune that he had of coming into the Newport Jazz Festival and getting on the cover of Time magazine, which pretty much ensured that for the rest of his life, people who didn't necessarily know much about jazz would know who he was. And you mentioned Ed Sullivan. Ed Sullivan is television exposure generally, but Sullivan in particular is enormously important to Ellington in those last 20 years of his life, because he is, as we said earlier, this personality. I looked through thousands of photographs to choose the ones for the book, and they're all good. You can't take a bad picture of Duke Ellington. So you put a guy like that on television, and television was made for him, just like it was made for Louis Armstrong. So even if Ellington went on Ed Sullivan, maybe he wasn't playing particularly what you wanted to hear, or the bill was an odd mixed one. The fact was that it was going out to the largest audience in television.
Yeah, but I think we're straying away from the point I'm trying to get from you. And we were talking about how Ellington was a terrible organizer, mm-hmm, while simultaneously he's facing the reality of rock and roll becoming a dominant part of the culture and rhythm and blues taking away the audience. I mean, right, he faced Frank Sinatra before. I mean, if he was yesterday's news, could any amount of mad organization revive his career? I mean, he had so many shots there with the Newport thing and all that.
If he'd lived another 15 years, I don't know what his life would have been like.
Yeah.
I mean, he and Louis Armstrong, who died around the same time, you know, early to mid-70s, remember that Armstrong made the last number one pop single, Hello Dolly, which was jazz.
Yeah.
After that, never again. So they may have died at a particularly fortuitous moment. It would have gotten harder for Ellington. The bookings, they weren't drying up, but they were becoming more difficult in the 70s. You know, part of genius is having good timing.
Yeah.
And maybe he knew when to make the exit.
Well, I mean, maybe I'm going to propose another thing, and I was hoping you could actually remark upon this. Sure. I got so caught up in all the ribald songs of the late 1920s. You set me down like a YouTube rabbit hole.
Oh,
loved
right.
Bessie Smith's Kitchen, man. I was just cracking up on that. You focus on these songs at the Cotton Club that were written by Jimmy McHugh, lyrics by Dorothy Fields.
And later on by Harold Arlen. I mean, there were some high class people writing this smut.
Yes, and it's wonderful. But my question is in light of how the Duke was essentially emulating pop in his later years, wearing the sort of mod suits, doing the Beatles songs and all that. I mean, I'm wondering if he needed to mimic someone, and whatever he was mimicking, whether it be these ribald songs by McHugh and Fields or whatever else, that he almost needed kind of a playfully bawdy, a little bit of a risk-averse thing to riff off of so he can establish his particular tone and remain au courant.
There's something to that. The thing you have to remember about Duke Ellington, and it may not be obvious to people 50 years later, is that he's really sexy.
Yeah.
He's sexy as a personality. The music is sexy. Often the music is about sex.
Do you find him sexy?
Well, I personally do not find him sexy. But I can see why other people do. I mean, a piece like, you know, there's a very famous Duke Ellington ballad called Warm Valley.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what it's about. He got that onto the record label, I suppose, because the people who ran RCA were innocent. But it's very important to his appeal. It's a fundamentally sensual appeal. And that wasn't like a wig he put on. This was a guy, you know, who pretty much had a different woman every night for large parts of his life. And
managing upwards to 4 or 5 hotel rooms at the same time in one city.
I boggle at his sexual ubiquity. But
there's something for an efficiency expert there to kind of take away from.
You know? Well, that part he handled very efficiently, but. You know, it was an important part of him. I mean, he was just accompanying the dirty songs of the Cotton Club. He didn't, relatively few of them actually got recorded. They were part of the total Cotton Club package. But the sensuality, that is part and parcel of what we think of when we think of Duke Ellington.
Yeah. I want to mention, because I thought this was amazing, Jimi Hendrix's Wah Wah was actually influenced by Bubber Miley's solo in East St. Louis, Toodaloo.
That's exactly right.
And I immediately listened to that clip, and then I listened to All Along the Watchtower, because I immediately said, that's All Along the Watchtower. It's mm-hmm. the same Wah 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 song. Mm-hmm. And you really hear the influence if you play the two clips. I may have to put them in the show so people get the sense of it. But, you know, in the early days of the Duke Ellington band, Duke surrounded himself with these very innovative musicians. He was unquestionably a master harmonist. Right. I think everyone would say that. But is it safe to say that his musicians were possibly more responsible for these innovative and influential aspects that touched maestros like Hendrix?
Responsible is a tricky word. I think you have to see Ellington as the auteur of the Ellington band. He is the person who hears a Bubber Miley and says, first, I want that. And second, I know what to do with that. That said, without Miley, the Ellington sound would probably have been very different. That's true of maybe somewhere between half a dozen and 10 of the key soloists who came through the band. And Ellington was very aware of how important they were to him. And he may have not necessarily wanted to cut them in on the royalties to songs that he wrote by lifting melodic fragments of theirs if he could get away with it. But he was utterly generous about featuring them on the bandstand, making sure that they had identities, making sure that you knew who Johnny Hodges was, you knew who Cootie Williams was, and also creating these fantastically beautiful and original settings for their playing. Remember that these guys, whatever gripes they had with Ellington being a credit hog or a money hog, they kept coming back. Johnny Hodges spent most of his adult life in that band. Harry Carney spent all of his adult life in that band. He came in as a teenager and he died a couple of months after Ellington did.
Cootie Williams, he leaves the Ellington band for Benny Goodman in 1942, and this even inspires a Raymond Scott composition.
That's right, when Cootie left the Duke.
It seems to be at the end of Duke's golden years, but eventually Cootie comes back. They all do, as we've just established. Clark Terry actually fears that if he becomes fully absorbed in the Ellington organism, he is going to reach a point where he will not be able to function without the Duke. So,
yes, that's one of the most interesting things that I ran across, is Terry, who played with Ellington in the 50s and early 60s, talking about this. Because Clark Terry emerged as a major jazz soloist and a powerfully individual one. So, but before this, you know, he's played with Count Basie, he comes into the Ellington band, and suddenly, you know, he's in the magic jewel box of lined with just the perfect velvet and these settings for his playing, and everything works out well. But Terry had greater ambitions, and he thought to himself, I don't want to get too comfortable here because maybe I won't become myself. Because it is absolutely true that except for Hodges and Ben Webster, nearly all of Ellington's best soloists just didn't function nearly as well when they tried to go it on their own. They didn't have that. It's hard to say what they didn't have. I mean, it may have just been that it's the difference between playing pieces written by a genius and playing standards. But Hodges functioned for a number of years without Ellington, but it was just too hard. You know, it's hard leading a band, and it was really hard leading a band in the 50s. So they came back, and they were willing to put up with whatever they had to put up with because it was advantageous to them. They did their own cost-benefit analysis.
But in the case of Strayhorn, as you point out, I think he used the phrase, he could have made it out on his own about three times in relation to Strayhorn. It's one of the most tragic aspects of Duke Ellington. I mean, he was aware, clearly, that he was also becoming absorbed in the organism, in the Ellington organism. I mean, the credits that we were talking about earlier. I mean, what was it that kept them coming back? Were they masochists? How aware were they that they were actually being...
Some were more aware than others. It was more important to some than others to establish independent reputations. I mean, Hodges, remember, everybody knew that Johnny Hodges was one of the greatest jazz alto saxophonists of the century. So Hodges didn't have to do anything for people to know who he was. I think when you mention Strayhorn and you use the word tragic, I think that's exactly right. If Strayhorn had not been a homosexual, the whole picture, how he would have structured his career, would have been different. And he might have left behind a larger independent body of work. On the other hand, because of the Ellington organization, he was able to leave behind a substantial and significant body of work that we remember him for today, and I think we'll always remember him for. Everybody makes a bargain. Strayhorn made his. He understood that it was a bargain. He made it when he was young, you know, barely out of his teens, and he didn't know in 1939 how he would feel about it 20 years later.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact remains that he did stay, other than that brief hiatus when he tried going off on his own, he did stay with the band because, all in all, it was the best deal he could get out of life.
Mm-hmm.
I think that would be the best way to put it.
There's one thing I really must mention, and that is Edna Ellington, Duke's wife.
Oh, yes.
She only gave one interview to Ebony's Mark Crawford in 1959, and this infuriated Duke. But here's the thing. Neither Duke nor Edna wanted a divorce, and they were able to keep this marriage secret from the public for decades. We also know that Edna may have been the one to slash Duke's face, hoping to spoil his pretty looks.
Yes.
But... And this could be one of the reasons why he has that scar on his left cheek.
That is the reason why he has that scar on the front cover of this book.
Yes. So did Duke stay married to Edna just to justify his philandering and to also string along poor Evie Ellis? Were you able to determine any other motivations for why they stayed married for so long?
I think that on some level, Duke Ellington, like many people with the Don Juan complex, was either afraid of women or deeply distrustful of them. And because of this, having a wife always gives him the excuse to not do the things that he doesn't want to do, starting with marry somebody else. That was the thing of all things that he didn't want to do, was to be tied down to any other woman. What Edna got out of it, not to put too fine a point on it, was money. A lifetime of financial support, you know, the distinction of being Mrs. Duke Ellington, even though the marriage itself had been dead from 1929 onward, So it's not hard to see what was in it for her. But I think what was in it for him was protection from this species that he really distrusted. And perhaps you would too if your wife came after you with a razor in bed one night because you were catting around on her. But Ellington's relations to women, his attitudes toward them, could be the stuff of an epic poem or maybe someday a play. I thought about writing an Ellington play. I didn't want to write a one-man play about Ellington. I got the idea, and I'm not saying that I'm going to do this, but I got the idea of writing a play whose cast would consist of four women.
Mm-hmm.
The women who knew Ellington, that Ellington himself would never be seen in the play. Because I think that would be very interesting, because his women, except for that one interview that Edna gave, didn't go on record about the relationship. I mean, some of the shorter-term relations, women did talk about him after his death, but mostly they kept their mouths shut. So that's a side of his life that, if not completely opaque, is difficult for us to see into.
What kind of search did you do to try to get any kind of scrap of paper from these women? I mean...
One of them was deposed for an oral history project.
Yeah.
His last serious girlfriend was a woman named Betty McGettigan, and she was deposed at Yale, and that was helpful. She was going to write a book, but died before she made any progress with it. It's just not there. I mean, I think they understood what a high priority it was for him to keep his private life secret, and I think they basically all seem to have accepted the bargain. But I have found no body of correspondence. It wasn't until very late in the process of writing this book that I turned up anything, interviews in which Freddie Washington, the woman who possibly may have inspired the razor attack, the famous very light-skinned black actress who could have passed for white but chose not to back in the 20s and 30s, where I found interviews in which she talked about him, however carefully. The material is just not there. There's gossip. You know, there's like a whole network of Ellington gossip and people who won't be quoted and things like that. But
did they talk with you saying off the record during that?
But it's all secondhand.
I see.
You know, it's so-and-so told me 20 years ago that X.
Ah.
And some of it sounds quite plausible. But, you know, there's a difference between plausible and usable.
Yeah.
Of course, everybody's dead now. So we're not going to know. I don't think we're going to know much more about Duke Ellington's love life than is in this book. And, you know, I didn't want to write a book about Duke Ellington's love life.
Yeah.
It figures prominently in the book because it figured prominently in his life. But we are interested in it now because it was part of what inspired him to make the music. This is something that he himself said many times to many people, that he found inspiration in women, and quite specifically, he said, in sex.
Yeah. Did you ever find out whatever happened to the Countess Ferdinanda de Castromonte?
I know she died.
Yeah.
But that's it. She just seems to have dropped off the surface of the earth in, you know.
She just seemed like the ultimate fake, basically, from what I can gather from your book.
She
anyway.
Was a very real fake, I guess you would say. I mean, she
a fake who contained multitudes.
Yeah, she was an exotic foreigner. She was perhaps not quite as exotic as she wanted you to think, and she was the right woman at the right moment for Ellington, because remember, she enters his life right in that period in the 50s where the world seems to be pulling away from him, and, you know, it's Elvis Presley who's on the television and not him. And suddenly there comes this fantastically exotic woman who is absolutely prepared to lick his feet. You know, she just wanted to do his bidding. That is... That is correct. And Ellington is in middle age. He's having a late midlife crisis. Even geniuses have them. And she was the right woman at the right time for him. But even the Countess would not receive the exclusive treatment. He wanted no woman to have exclusivity in his life, ever.
Yeah. Let's talk about Duke's politics, which are extremely interesting and contradictory. I mean, he remains silent about playing these segregated clubs. He believes that the only way to fight segregation is to raise money and pay people.
Right.
He took a dim view of the March on Washington in 1963, saying that the only people who did good out of the goddamn parade was the people who owned businesses in Washington, the hotels, and all that.
Yeah.
But then he wins the NAACP's Spingarn Medal, and he tries to be more responsible. So his commitment to racial justice is really interesting. It springs more about what's good for business. So I'm wondering, I mean, you get into his National Front activities a bit, which he later backpedals on.
Right. You've got to see him in historical context. You've got to remember that this is a guy who's born at the end of the 19th century. Ellington's politics, like Louis Armstrong's politics, make more sense when you see them in that larger context, that his ideas about what a black is as a public figure are formed in the teens and 20s. It's a different era. Ellington felt that his contribution to the civil rights movement was, I don't say this frivolously, to be Duke Ellington, to be this fantastically elegant, presentable genius who can go anywhere. That's not true, but you know, you got the impression that he could, and do anything, and who at the end of his life is feted at the White House, has given his 70th birthday party at the White House by Nixon. And Ellington, by some accounts, we don't have that firsthand from him, but more than one person said that he told them that he had been a lifelong Republican. Now, okay, what does that mean? It means something different for a black man born in 1899.
Yeah.
Whose ideas about party affiliation predate Franklin Roosevelt, for example. I think, by and large, Ellington, except for the specific matter of race, is largely politically indifferent.
Huh.
It's just, and Armstrong was too. I mean, these are people who travel around too much to vote, who don't feel specifically vested in a particular place, a particular neighborhood. Racial matters are of central importance to them, but not so much else, I don't think. Ellington's involvement with the Popular Front, which led to the writing of his most successful stage work, the musical revue Jump for Joy, he's not a communist, you know. I mean, he's in fact, it probably didn't mean all that much to him in 1940. Within a few years, he is an active and fairly aggressive anti-communist.
Yes.
But he's just not a strongly political figure at all. I mean, for Ellington, being an anti-communist is partly religious.
Yeah.
We haven't touched on that side of his life, but Duke Ellington was an extremely idiosyncratic, but nevertheless devout religious believer. And for him, the problem with communism was that it was anti-God. It's really as simple as that.
But I think the distinction I wanted to make here on his politics was that he doesn't seem to have any political commitment that isn't pecuniary in some way. I mean, it's very much related to business. Racial equality, racial justice, this is going to happen if you pay people and if they're essentially employers. And
right.
I'm wondering if he had anything
totally,
outside of that.
No, he's totally pragmatic.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not that it doesn't have deeper meaning for him, but it's that he's entirely realistic about it. And again, he relates it to his experience. How does Duke Ellington become famous? By playing in the Cotton Club. What does this mean in terms of his career? It means everything in terms of his career. He knows that for a black man of his generation, fame and money are the road to equality. And so that becomes his sense of how you do things, how you succeed. That was his view of the situation.
But in terms of taking the Spingarn Medal and trying to actually honor it, I mean, again, this goes back to the theory I've been sort of suggesting, even with the body songs,
mm-hmm.
that he needs to have something presented to him in order to run with it. And I'm wondering if possibly politically that was kind of his.
I don't think so. I mean, the thing to remember at all times about Duke Ellington is that he is a member of the black bourgeoisie, and it is very important to him to be respectable. No, he wants to live his life the way he wants to live it, but in public he wants to be respectable, and so he never divorces Edna. So he will actually go so far as to pay gossip columnists not to write stuff about him. Appearance is important to him, and you can see why it would be, because it's important to him as an artist, as a celebrity, as a presenter. It makes sense that he should generalize and see it as also as being politically important to him. But I don't think he was trying. He was glad to get the Spingarn Medal, you know. I mean, It was a medal. It was a very prestigious thing. He liked medals. There's a section in Music Is My Mistress, his autobiography, where he just lists all the awards that he got, including some pretty comical ones, too. You know, I mean, I can't quote it off from memory, but, you know, Mr. Rooster of 1946 and Podunk or things like that.
Yeah.
And again, it makes sense if you turn back to the background. You know, black middle class, Washington, D.C., turn of the century. This is respectability. It's important to him to get honorary degrees. It was devastating to him not to get a Pulitzer Prize.
Yeah.
That was a big, big thing for him. If he'd had any detachment, emotional detachment from this, he would have said, I'm bigger than the Pulitzer Prize. They would honor themselves by giving it to me. But he didn't think that way.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't think that way.
There are moments in this book that I call the tight-lipped teach-out moment. I love this. I get this from all your books. But it comes especially like when John Hammond shows up. I can see you writing these passages and you really want to go ahead and rail into him. But then, nope, we must be the respectful biographer.
No, I think of it as let them hang themselves.
Oh, I see. That's, I mean, I'm wondering
that's
why...
That's the deadpan.
I know you've got the deadpan thing. But yeah. I'm wondering, why not just go ahead and lay into some of these people?
I just think it's more effective the other way, to tell you the truth. I mean, a character like John Hammond...
And by the way, you have a huge expression on your face like, oh, John Hammond.
Well, he doesn't need me to do him in. What he needs is to be quoted correctly.
Yeah.
And then the effect produces itself. I mean, I think you're right to point that as something that I prefer to do in my books. Maybe it's the dramatist's instinct. But rather than commenting on that which doesn't need comment, I would rather just let them present themselves, if possible, in a dramatic situation. To me, the funniest moment in the book, and some other people have said this to me as well, is where Hammond, you know, tears into Ellington's Reminiscing in Tempo, and you know, says it's effete and it's proof that he's, you know, he's gone white on us. That's basically what Hammond was saying. Great to have John Hammond saying such a thing. And then...
At the Congress Hotel.
Right, at the Congress Hotel, you know. Duke Ellington plays this instrumental piece, and Hammond comes up to him afterwards and says, oh, Duke, that was marvelous. That was the true, authentic Duke. And it's Reminiscing in Tempo.
Yeah.
You know, to simply tell that story, I think, is a more effective way of putting Hammond in his place than to jump on his head.
I also wanted to talk about some of the difficulties of synthesizing one man's life for a biography, specifically in relation to Mercer Ellington,
yes,
Duke's son. I mean, his presence in this book, when he shows up midway through the book, I had to kind of say to myself, wait a minute, did I miss him at the very beginning? I know that you mentioned him, and I went back, oh yeah, no, Terry, you mentioned him.
He's right there.
But the thing is his life goes by so fast in the way you depict it that I didn't get any real sense of what Duke was like as a father. So when Mercer is born, you got these brisk zooms. And while this certainly mimics the brisk, peripatetic nature of Duke's own life, I have to ask if there really are enough documents or material out there to give us a sense of what Duke was like as a father, or was
not beyond Mercer's own autobiography, which is one of the half dozen most important primary sources on Ellington, although it has to be taken with a stalactite of salt, obviously,
yeah.
Because Mercer's the quintessential relationship between a genius and a talented son, talented being the operative word. Mercer was not without talent, but he wasn't Duke Ellington. Mercer doesn't, and remember also that Mercer didn't live with Duke after the separation other than from time to time. Mercer doesn't become an important presence in Duke's life until 40, 41, when, because of the ASCAP strike, suddenly Mercer and Billy Strayhorn have to start writing music for Ellington.
Yeah.
And from that point on, Mercer is more present in Ellington's life. But I think it's pretty safe to say that what Ellington was a detached father who spent most of his life on the road. And there's not much more to say about it than that.
Yeah.
And if you want to know more about Mercer, reading his memoir is the thing to do, as long as you take it with the necessary requisite detachment.
Yeah. I wanted to bring up Herb Jeffries, who is a figure I have been looking into in the last
couple
of years.
Who is still with us.
Yes.
The last surviving member of the Great Ellington Band of 4041.
Made a series of westerns, Harlem on the Prairie, The Bronze Buckaroo, that featured the first black cowboy.
Right.
Of course, he was a singer in Duke Ellington's band. John Garfield once told Jeffries, "You don't seem to fit the right shade," so Jeffries goes ahead and he uses makeups to darken his skin.
Right, this is in Jump for Joy, the stage
yes,
show.
Yes, exactly. Duke is infuriated there too. But what's interesting about this, and I'm pretty sure you know this, is that Herb Jeffries was actually doing that for the cowboy movies. And and I'm wondering, you know, to what degree Duke's performers had to suffer in the indignities of wearing makeup like this, and to what degree did they resist it? Did Duke's anger stem
only two examples that I'm aware of in the Ellington literature. When they were making their first film, which was Check and Double Check, the feature film for Amos and Andy, where there is a bandstand scene that shows the entire band, the two lightest-skinned members of the band, Barney Bagard and Juan Tizol, were expected to darken their skin for the film. And they were outraged by this. And it became a news story in the black press. You know, because that is, I mean, back then, that was huge. Even then, even in 1929, that was considered an outrage that they would have to do this. And then the episode that Jeffries reports on, when John Garfield thought that, you know, he looked too light and needed to darken up. And Ellington, who was unusually sensitive to questions of intra-racial prejudice, it's easy to see how that would have caused him to blow up. Because for Ellington, Jump for Joy, which was the popular front stage review in Los Angeles in 41, you know, that was his idea of the kind of racial statement he wanted to make. And to have his male singer wearing, you know, shoe polish or whatever it was that he put on, what could be more outrageous? What could be more insulting? And John Garfield was perfectly well-meaning. I have no doubt about this.
Yeah.
You know, but he didn't understand what kind of button he was pushing.
Yeah. Did anybody really understand what button they were pushing at the time? I mean, I saw a few clips of Duke, and he's often playing to these white audiences, and they're just sitting there completely stone-faced, just not comprehending, one, why they're doing there,
right.
Two, what they're hearing. I mean, you know, how much was it the music and how much of it was race in terms of this incomprehension?
Some people were hip and some people were not. I think it's really as simple as that. You had a substantial minority of hip white listeners in the 20s, 30s, and 40s who did get it, many of whom were or became musicians themselves. You also had a lot of people who just liked the pretty tunes and danced to them. Remember that Duke Ellington, throughout his career, to the end of his career, is spending a lot of time playing for dances at country clubs and things like that. We forget what the working life of a big band is. It's not all Carnegie Hall. Most of it isn't Carnegie Hall. And Ellington knew how to give pleasure both in Carnegie Hall and in the local country club setting, you know, where he'd play what came to me notice as the dreaded medley of his hits. You know, Duke Ellington was a very great artist and a very great composer, but he never, ever, ever forgot which side of the bread the butter was on. He knew that he had to have the popular audience. He had to bring it with him. It was the popular audience that allowed him to do what he wanted, that allowed him to have that band on the road 52 weeks a year if he wanted to. And so he always took care of them.
Yeah.
Always.
He, like anybody else during that time, was beholden to market demands.
Of course.
Yeah. And the market demands at the time resulted in some of these.
I think the amazing thing is not that he was beholden to the market, but that in spite of the market, he was able to make music of permanent, immortal interest and make it in this kind of setting. I mean, the most famous live recording of the Ellington Band was made in 1940 in Fargo, North Dakota. It just happened to be recorded by a couple of guys who had a fancy rig. And they've just come into Fargo to play a dance, one of these, you know, country club-like dances that I'm talking about. This is maybe one of the half dozen greatest performing organizations of any kind, jazz, classical, what have you. And we just catch them doing their job. And that room full of people, they're not sitting in seats, they're dancing. And yet what they're dancing to is music like Coco and the other immortal masterpieces of the 1940-41 Ellington Band. To me, the great miracle is that for this fairly brief moment in the history of jazz, popular taste and sophisticated musical compositional taste have converged, and you can have people dancing to one of the great masterpieces of the 20th century.
Well, on that note, that seems a good end to this conversation. Terry, thanks so much. It was a pleasure to chat.
Well, it's always a pleasure to chat with you.